Gulf Coast State College, Anatomy and Physiology, The Senses, Part 1. Let's start out with this overview slide and break the senses down into two general groups. First comes what we call the special senses. And those are smell, taste, vision, hearing, and the fill in the blank on this slide. And whenever I ask my face-to-face classes what the fifth special sense is, they always say touch. And that is incorrect. I know that's what they told you in high school, but they messed you up in high school. The fifth special sense is actually balance. And the way I remember it is all five special senses are in my head, right? My nose for smell, my tongue for taste, my eyes for vision, and my inner ears for hearing and balance. Then we have all the other senses, and they'll fall into the category called general senses. Those are further broken down into the somatic and the visceral senses. Let your root words help you, and that will get you through this classification. Soma refers to body. So the somatic senses are our general body senses, like pain, temperature, touch, pressure, vibration, and my favorite one, proprioception. Remember that? That's the ability to perceive the position and movement of our parts in space, even with our eyes closed, like swinging your arm around over your head on the dance floor. The other general sense category are called visceral senses, the root word viscera. It just means your guts. If you've seen a deer processed, they eviscerate the deer. That just means they take the guts out. So visceral senses provide information about our internal organs, our guts, so to speak. But it doesn't matter what sense we talk about, a special sense or a general sense, the process of sensation always follows these same four basic steps, which you gotta know stone cold. It doesn't matter if we're talking about sight, smell, touch, or whatever. Here's how the process of sensation goes. Step number one, some sensory receptor somewhere will be stimulated, either in your eye or nose or your skin or whatever. Then comes step number two. This is truly the magical step. This is where the fascinating part happens. Step number two is transduction of the stimulus by the sensory receptor. What does that mean? First of all, you should know what the word transduction means. Transduce means to change. And the energy of the stimulus, whatever the stimulus is, if it's light energy or mechanical energy or chemical energy, must be converted by the sensory receptor into electrical energy. Why? And this is a big picture kind of point. Because the only thing the brain can understand and process is electrical energy. So that's why we must transduce or change the energy of the stimulus into electrical. I mean, you can't just show a movie and shine it onto your occipital lobe and expect it to really see the movie. You can't play music against your temporal lobe and expect your temporal lobe to be able to hear it. You must change the energy of the stimulus into electrical. Which leads to step number three. A sensory nerve impulse will be generated, which will travel along a sensory neuron, which will be sent up into the central nervous system. Essentially, we're talking about the brain here, where step number four takes place is integration or processing, so you could receive and perceive what you just saw or heard or felt. So those are the four steps in the process of sensation. Your book classifies sensory receptors different ways. I just pick my favorite way because it's the easiest way. just by looking at these words, I bet you can tell what these receptors sense without even checking out my slides. I'm going to skip by nociceptors and go to thermoreceptors first. Guess what thermoreceptors sense? They sense temperature, mostly warm and cool. What about chemoreceptors? They sense chemicals. Then we'll look at osmoreceptors very briefly. And they sense osmolarity, or in English, they sense saltiness of our body fluids. Photoreceptors, the name tells you, they sense photons, which means they sense light. Finally, mechanoreceptors sense anything mechanical. So let's talk about these in order. Starting with the nociceptors, the reason maybe that one you couldn't figure out right off the bat is maybe you don't know the root word noce. Root word noce means noxious or toxic. It means something harmful. So our nociceptors, you should write down here, are our pain receptors. What are they? Where are they? Let's talk a little bit about nociceptors. Nociceptors are free nerve endings. What does that mean in English? They are bare, unmyelinated dendrites. For example, here in the skin, showing you some nociceptors, some pain receptors. These are the dendrites of some neuron, and they are bare. That means unmyelinated dendrites. That is what our pain receptors are. These are located in every tissue of the body except one. And, of course, you got to know it. It's the brain. That's why you can, and they still do, operate on the brain while the patient's awake. Now, you got to get through the skin and the skull first. You know, you got to put them out for that. But then you can wake the patient up and operate on their brain while they're awake, and that's very useful during brain surgery, as some of you may see as you get along into your clinicals. There's some really cool videos to Google on brain surgery, and you could actually see the patient being operated on while they're awake. What do nociceptors sense? Yes, they sense pain. And also, please mark this down, temperature extremes. That means really, really, really hot and really, really, really cold fall into this category of being sensed by nociceptors. So if I poke someone with a red hot poker, that is not sensed by a thermoreceptor, it's sensed by a nociceptor. If I dump a cup of liquid nitrogen on my head, that is going to be sensed by a pain receptor, not by a thermoreceptor. On this slide, I also want to introduce, because I want you to know, the concept of adaptation. What is adaptation? In general, that means if you stimulate any sensory receptor over and over and over again, it's eventually going to get used to it. I'll give you a couple examples. Last time you fixed a tub of water for a bath, when you first stick your toe in there, it might feel really hot, but then you kind of ease your way in after about a minute. And did the temperature of the water really drop, you know, 10 or 20 degrees in that 1 minute? No. Your body got used to it. It adapted to it. That's actually an example of rapid adaptation, because our thermoreceptors for warm and cool, they do adapt rapidly. Another example, you walk in the store, they got music on in the background. We used to call that Muzak. You hear it when you first go in, but then after you shop for a while, you don't even know what's going on. That's another example of adaptation. But for pain receptors, I want you to know they're slowly adapting. Why? Write it down on this slide. Why are our pain receptors slowly adapting? To protect you. For example, when someone comes in the emergency room with really bad belly pain. They call that acute belly pain. Do you just immediately slap them with a whole bunch of morphine to knock that pain out? Of course not. You want to be able to follow the nature, the characteristics, the development, the timing, the location of the pain, because that helps you arrive at the proper diagnosis. How else are you going to tell the difference between bad gas and appendicitis? You can't just knock them all down with morphine right from the get-go. Or how about this? I'm walking across the room right now. I fall, I slip, I break my femur, and I'm in extreme pain. Then all of a sudden, 2 minutes later, it feels better. It's like, okay, I'm good to go now. That wouldn't be right, would it? Because I could be in serious danger with a broken femur. So our pain receptors are slowly adapting. If I take a pair of vice grip pliers and I crunch my forearm with it, it's going to hurt now. It's going to hurt a minute from now, an hour from now, and even several hours from now. It's still going to hurt. I think you get the idea. On this slide, I'd like to talk about another very important concept called referred pain. You know, the number one reason people come to see us as healthcare providers is pain. Something hurts. And it all starts with knowing the anatomy, because if you know where the parts are, you generally know where to begin as far as helping that patient, because usually where we hurt is where the problem is, but not always. Give you an example. People have heart attacks. Sometimes, yep, they'll have chest pain where the heart is, but sometimes they won't. Sometimes they'll have pain maybe just running down their left arm, and many of you may have heard of that. So is our heart in our left arm? Well, of course not. But the short story is, just the way we're hooked up, just the way our wiring is, sometimes the first sign, or maybe even the only sign of a heart attack, will be pain running down that left arm, or sometimes running up into the jaw as well. Another example is a gallbladder attack. You know where the gallbladder is roughly, and yeah, people have pain there, but sometimes liver pain or gallbladder pain will show up in that right shoulder, and you'll use this knowledge to help you diagnose people. You can look at this diagram, the anterior and posterior view, and some of you say, yeah, you know, last time I had a bladder infection, my bladder area might hurt a little bit, but I noticed it also hurt in the back of my thighs and buttocks. That's not where my bladder is, but that's where I had pain. And physicians, healthcare providers use this to help them. This is another one of those things, by the way, a little inside secret I'll give you. Don't tell anybody I told you this, but you know, when you tell the doctor, oh, my right shoulder hurts and also my whatever belly hurts, they go in, they say, wait a minute, just a minute, I'll be right back. They leave the room, they go find this pretty map, and they say, aha, yeah, if this area hurts here around the diaphragm and the right shoulder hurts at the same time, maybe we're talking about a gallbladder problem. So then they come back in the room all real smart and say, yeah, I think we might have a liver or gallbladder problem. Let's go ahead and do some tests. Inside secret, don't tell anybody. Thermoreceptors, nothing really big to say on this slide. What are they? Where are they? Once again, they are free nerve endings. That means they're bare, unmyelinated dendrites. In the skin and the mucous membranes, just think about any place you could sense warm or cool. Mucous membranes of the mouth, vagina, anus, and so forth. Then comes chemoreceptors. Very simply, they detect chemicals in the mouth, in the nose, and in body fluids. Some of those we've already talked about. Osmoreceptors, we talked about those, for example, in the hypothalamus. They sense, you got it, they sense osmolarity. That means, in English, they sense the saltiness of our body fluids. Photoreceptors, again, easy. They detect light in the retina. Root word photo refers to light. We'll look at those in detail later on. Finally, mechanoreceptors detect anything mechanical. You touch something, pull on it, tug it, pressure, vibration, hearing, balance, Proprioception, our old friend, all sensed by mechanoreceptors. The one thing I want you to circle on this slide is hearing and balance. A lot of students forget that those are senses that are sensed by mechanical receptors. We will discuss those in detail later in this unit. Now we're ready to bust into the special senses, starting with olfaction. Know your root words. What does olfaction mean? Olfaction means the sense of smell. And to understand the sense of smell, we have to understand what's going on in the nose. Here's this picture off to the side to your far left, a sagittal view of the nose cut open. You're looking into the right side. And again, I don't know about you, but before I ever took this course, I thought like the whole inside of my nose probably had smell receptors in it. But remember, it's just this 1-inch purple patch of mucosa at the top of your nose. That's the only part that could smell. That is what we call the olfactory epithelium. What your book did is suck this area out, blew it up really big, and here it is in a nice drawing. Let's break it down. If anybody ever asks you, the olfactory epithelium, that 1-inch oval patch of purple mucosa at the top of your nose, contains 3 special cells. Number 1, shown here in sort of a pale blue. These are the Mac Daddy cells. These are the olfactory receptors. In English, they're the smell cells. But don't call it smell cells on the test. I'll just laugh a little bit. Put olfactory receptors. I got a whole special slide just on them. Then we have, in sort of a tannish color, supporting cells. And I've got really nothing more to say about them. Supporting cells, guess what they do? They support. Then we have basal cells, shown as these triangular kind of purplish blue cells. And note, with a star, they are stem cells. And what could stem cells do? They could divide. They could multiply. They could differentiate. As a matter of fact, you need to write down that these are the cells that replace our olfactory receptors. Our olfactory receptors die about on a monthly basis, and they need to be replaced, or none of us would ever be able to smell again after the first month of life. What's also really cool here, if you looked ahead, you know this, olfactory receptors are neurons. With all the parts of neurons, you should already know, cell bodies, dendrites, axons. And let me ask you a question. Do neurons in the human body routinely replace themselves? And the answer is no. This is a rare case where neurons are being replaced. And if someone, maybe you, could figure out how the nose does it, then maybe you could figure out how to help our brain injury and spinal cord injury patients. Please be that person. And remember, also cut me in 1%. So that's the olfactory epithelium, but here's the problem. And I'm just a messenger. There's something else stuffed in there, but whoever made this up says it's not part of the olfactory epithelium. Doesn't make sense to me either, but we just got to know it this way. Here is this orange-looking deal, the cells, and that structure is called, or they are called, olfactory glands. They're sandwiched in the olfactory epithelium, but by definition, they're not part of the 3 cells. So that's just the way it is. And they are very important. They make mucus. And as we'll see, or as you already know, if your nose is really dried out, maybe from a cold medication, a decongestion, do you think smell as good as they used to smell? And the answer is no. We need the mucus, a proper amount of mucus, to be able to smell things at our best. Here's our separate slide just on the olfactory receptors. I'll outline them in pale blue. Remember, they are true neurons with cell bodies, with axons, and of course with dendrites. And the key point on this slide is poking from the tips of the dendrites into the mucus in the top of our nose are these special structures with a star on them called olfactory hairs. Olfactory hairs project from the dendrites. Now, they are not really hairs. They're more like a cilia. So when you see hairs growing out side of an old man's nose that needs a nose trimmer, those are not the olfactory hairs. That's a separate issue. Now that we know the basic parts and pieces, let's go ahead and talk about olfaction. Let's look at the process of smelling and the entire olfactory or smell pathway that I want you to know. So it goes like this. You're cooking on the grill and some odor molecules, shown here as these little red dots called odorants. You sniff them up and they go to the top of your nose and they get dissolved. That's the key. They get dissolved in the mucus. And when they get there, they go up and tickle and bind to and touch those olfactory hairs. They stimulate those hairs and generate electrical signals in the olfactory receptors. More technically, more correctly stated, that is, those magical structures called olfactory hairs transduce or change the chemical energy of the molecule of steak into electrical. So that what? So you can actually perceive what you just sensed. And here goes the pathway. Nerve impulses generated in the olfactory receptors travel along their axons. Here they are, those wires. These are axons. These are nerves. These are our old friend, the olfactory nerves, piercing the cribriform plate and synapsing, connecting to this structure, which I hope you all see in lab, called the olfactory bulbs. From the olfactory bulbs, the electrical signals then travel through a pathway that eventually lead to the part of the cerebrum that could receive and perceive what we just smelled with a star next to it. Because here's where you should be able to start connecting the dots with the brain chapter. Which part of the cerebrum is being able to actually have the ability to tell us what we just smelled? Remember which lobe of the brain it was? You got a 1 in 4 shot, only 4 lobes of the brain, and it's the temporal lobe. Remember, as a memorization technique, I said, okay, you got your ears over your temporal lobe, so your temporal lobe, you can remember, easily does the hearing, but now I want you to grow a nose out of your ears. Sort of a funky visual, but hopefully it will help you remember long term that it's the temporal lobe that helps you to smell. Okay, well, so what? Who cares? I want to talk about smell and how we have some practical applications of this. Your nose is actually a super-duper sensing device. I think your book says something like it's 10,000 times more sensitive than your sense of taste. Certainly, you know there are dogs that are trained to track things down because the sense of smell is so sensitive. Here's one way it's used. To give you an example. It's used for safety. It's used to protect us. Natural gas, for example, as it comes out of the ground, does it have any smell? And the answer is no. It's odorless. But a lot of people have natural gas in their house. And you sure wouldn't want to have a leak and have an explosion in the house. So what they do is they take advantage of the super-duper sensor called the nose. And they put just a little bit of stink juice inside the natural gas. It's not really stink juice. I think it's called methyl mercaptan. And your nose is so sensitive, they only have to put a really little bit in there. Something like 1/25 of a part per billion. In other words, a teeny tiny bit of stink juice. And if you have a gas leak, you could smell it. Always, you know, it comes up in the news once a year. Somebody's house, 1 minute is there, next minute, boom, toothpicks. What is it? A lot of times, a natural gas explosion. And the family usually got out in time because they smelled the leak. Let's give a clinical application to healthcare. I want to talk about Alzheimer's disease. It's becoming more prevalent as the population ages and as we find ways to make people live longer. So it won't be unheard of for one of us to have to encounter and take care of an Alzheimer's patient. If you've ever done that, that's one of the hardest things you'll ever do emotionally, socially, economically, physically. So wouldn't it be nice to detect Alzheimer's early and so you could treat it early once a treatment becomes available? So there's actually a test for Alzheimer's. You can check it out on the internet if you want to. And it's called the smell test. That's right. People who lose their sense of smell early, that might be a warning sign of Alzheimer's disease. Please Google it. Check it out. There's a test called a scratch and sniff test for Alzheimer's. And here's how someone figured that out. They just used basic A&P knowledge. They said, well, my nose is a super-duper sensor device. Here it is hanging off my face. And it's connected to my brain cells. It's connected to my cerebrum. And what happens in Alzheimer's? We lose brain cells. So using the nose as a super-duper sensor device, if we lose brain cells, including in our temporal lobe, that may be detected early on as a loss of the sense of smell. Fascinating, but yet so simple that someone thought of that. And even though we don't have a cure, wouldn't it be nice to detect it early? Because if you could detect it early, you could, you know, educate the patient and the family. They could get their house in order, so to speak. And if a cure does become available, you could be first in line for the cure. So yes, this is nice that we have this super duper sensor. And we'll talk about the sense of taste and how we perceive what we taste. And many of you already know that when our brain perceives what we taste, most of that actually comes from what we smell. That's how powerful and sensitive our sense of smell is. Our second special sense we'll talk about is gustation. You should know your root words. This is the sense of taste. To understand the sense of taste, we must understand some basic anatomy of the tongue. Here's a tongue kind of looking at you. The tongue has small projections, little bumps on the surface called papillae. And there are four types of papillae. We'll look at each of these one at a time in this order because I like to stay organized for you and me. The four types are valate, fungiform, foliate, and filiform. On this slide right now, I want you to draw a line in the sand right here. Split them right in half. Because one thing I want you to know, or you should just know, is the only types of papillae with taste buds are the valate and the fungiform. Below my line I'm drawing, foliate and filiform papillae do not have taste buds, certainly not in adults. Let's start with the valate papillae. Valate with a V are located on the back of the tongue in an upside down or inverted V shape. And yes, they do contain taste buds, if anyone asks you. I'm going to tell you a true story while you're maybe making some notes. When I was in college, for some reason I was standing in front of the mirror with a flashlight and I stuck out my tongue and I looked back there. I don't know what I was doing. But I noticed these big bumps, about 12 of them, on the back of my tongue. And I'd never seen them before in my whole life. And I thought for sure I had a tumor. So I went to the on-campus doctor. I said, doctor, I think I have a tumor. I got these big bumps on the back of my tongue. And he looked back there and he said, no. You've had those your whole life. You just never seen them before. Those are your valate papillae. And I'm not telling you to do this. But if you were to go home and look in the back of your tongue with a flashlight, you would see these big bumps back there. And if you've never seen them before, they're kind of surprising. But a little disclaimer here, one more time. Never do anything I say to do in this course. Just learn the material. The next type of papillae are shaped like a mushrooms. So they're called fungiform. Root word fungi means mushroom. They're scattered all over the entire surface of the tongue, essentially. And yes, these mushroom-shaped papillae, they do contain taste buds. Next comes foliate papillae. A folia root word means leaf-like, and the person who first found foliate papillae thought they kind of looked like a leaf. Here they are on the lateral back sides of the tongue. They have sort of a ridge-like appearance, and I usually draw a picture on the board and make these ridges, and then I draw another set of ridges and make what looks like a leaf. I don't know if you've ever seen a leaf got those kind of ridges in them. I always call those the veins of the leaf. I don't know if they're really called veins. I'm only a human biology type, but I call them the veins of the leaf. But the deal is that's how they got their name. And if you were to go home, and I'm not telling you to do this, but if you were to go home and stick your tongue out and sit in front of the mirror with a flashlight and then turn your tongue to the side, you would see these ridges on the lateral surface of your tongue. They do have taste buds, but they degenerate in childhood. So for my course, if I ask you, do adults have taste buds in the foliate papillae, you say no. Last but not least, we have filiform papillae, spelled right here. Filiform sounds like filaments, and they are kind of shaped like sharp little filaments. They, I guess, kind of help us grip our food, but they certainly don't contain taste buds. If you have a cat, you know what filiform papillae are, because cats have, like, the mother of all filiform papillae. If a cat ever licked you, it feels sharp like sandpaper. And they really do serve a function in cats for sure, because they can grab onto their food, holding it in their mouth. We had a cat one time named Tiger. He was an outside cat, and boy, he would snatch things right out of the air like birds and stuff, feathers everywhere. But he would, once that food was in his mouth, it wasn't coming out, and the filiform papillae helped him keep it in his mouth. This slide's rather simple. You can figure this out without even looking at it. You can close your eyes. If I asked you such a simple question as where are some of our basic taste sensations, all you have to do is close your eyes and think about it. For example, last time you had something really salty or really sweet, where could you taste that the best? Well, that was mostly on the tip of the tongue, wasn't it? What about sour? Like last time you had like a sour ball. My daughter, you know, she gave me these things called warheads one time. I said, have a warhead, Dad. And where did you sense that sourness? It was on the back sides of the tongue. So much that it almost hurts back there when you have those sour balls. So you never forget where the sour location generally is. What about bitter? Last time, maybe you had a really nasty glass of wine. Number one, I'm not condoning that behavior. Number two, many of you are probably too young to drink. This is just an example. But where did it leave the bitter aftertaste? Right on the back of the tongue. So these are easy to figure out. This reminds me of a true story, maybe while you're making notes. When I was in elementary school, I walked to school 1 mile uphill in the snow. It was only uphill one way. It was downhill the other way. But I remember at the end of the little pathway from coming home from school, there was always an ice cream truck there. And the ice cream truck always, well, of course, they sold ice cream, but they also sold candy. This was a long time ago. And they had one of my favorite kind of candies. And I'm not, this is not a commercial for this kind of candy, because you can't even hardly find it anymore. There's a candy called Zots. And when you put it in your mouth, it kind of, after it melts a little bit, it kind of foams up in this big foam explosion in your mouth. And when I was like 6 years old and I stopped with my ice cream money at the truck and instead I got Zots, we thought we were doing something really bad, like we were doing something really deviant, like, you know, buying, you know, drugs or something. Of course, I don't condone that either. I'm just giving an example of how times have changed. When we bought that candy, we really thought we were doing something bad. And then I told my daughter about it, who gave me a warhead, and I said, let me give you something else, because I found it somewhere. And I said, here, try this. And I gave her a Zot. And she was like mildly impressed. She says, that's nothing. You gotta try these things called Crackle Rocks or Pop Rocks or something. I don't know what they were. But she gave me a whole bag of them. I put the whole bag in my mouth at one time. It was like nothing. It was like Rice Krispies. So anyway, Zots were the bomb compared to those Pop Rocks or whatever they're called. Okay, well, enough of that. Let's talk about how we taste. And the neat thing is, it's going to be real similar setup to how we smelled. So here we go. The receptors for taste are located in taste buds. Here's a taste bud. Taste buds have cells. It's going to sound familiar. Here's a basal stem cell. Those are the cells that divide and multiply and replace our taste receptor cells very often, as a matter of fact. Our taste receptor cells usually only last about 10 days. They die off, got to be replaced pretty often. And you're familiar with this. Think of last time maybe you had a hot cup of coffee, right? Burned your tongue, couldn't taste things for a while. But in a matter of days, it came back because these stem cells can divide pretty quickly. Then we got supporting cells here in like a pinkish tan. Got nothing more to say about them. They just support. But the Mac Daddy cell is the gustatory receptor cell, shown here in blue. And the key piece of this cell, where all the magic happens once again, I have a star on it, is a gustatory hair. So now that we know the pieces, parts, how does it work? Should be a fairly similar story. Here it is. I eat my steak, I chew it up, mash it into molecules. Those dissolved chemicals dissolved in our saliva, very important because you can't taste things well without your saliva, come in contact with and tickle and bind to those gustatory hairs, where the magic happens, because those gustatory hairs change or transduce the chemical energy of the steak molecule into electrical energy, because that's all our brain could understand. So what's the rest of the pathway? Well, those receptor cells they synapse with our cranial nerves for taste that we already studied, which eventually relay those impulses through the relay station in the brain that you know, to the part of our cerebrum that can interpret what we just tasted. Which lobe of the brain does that? Remember, you got a 1-in-4 shot. And it's the parietal lobe. Pencil it in now. This is nice to connect all the dots from all these different chapters. And my little saying that I hope helps you remember long term is, you can't taste grandma's apple pie without the parietal lobe. You know, the parietal lobe for real. So that's my little memorization technique. Let's go ahead and do a little bit of a vision before we end this unit. This is just a picture of the structures we're going to study. We're going to start with the accessory structures of the eye. What does accessory mean? Because there's lots of accessory structures in different parts of anatomy. In general, accessory means to help. So these are all the structures we're looking at in this figure that are around the eye, but are not the eyeball. So these are things that help the eyeball, surround the eyeball, but ain't the eyeball. Here's a list of about 7 things. It's just a laundry list. Don't get nervous. We'll look at those things one at a time, organized in that order. Let's begin with eyebrows and eyelashes. Your A&P students, I sure hope I don't have to point them out to you on the slide, and I'm not going to read the slide to you. What does it say? All this says is eyebrows and eyelashes are there to protect you. Don't believe me? Wait till you see your first patients with chemotherapy. Yep, they lose their hair, sometimes including eyebrows and eyelashes. And as a former eye doctor, I saw a lot more chemotherapy patients come in with eye injuries because when they're walking around, like maybe a construction site, the wind blew something in their eye, and I would have to take, you know, a piece of trash out off from their cornea or what have you. And yes, they do serve a protective function. Then we have the eyelids. Again, I hope I don't have to point them out to you here, but this is a right eye looking at you with a right and with a right upper and right lower eyelid. But I do want you to know the technical name for eyelids are palpebrae. Palpebrae spelled here is what you should fill in the blank. What's the purpose? I'm not going to read the slide again to you. You can read that. But the big picture is eyelids are to protect you, to protect and lubricate. Wait till you see your first trauma patient, maybe a motorcycle accident victim where the eyelids can get sheared off the eye. I've seen that. It's called an avulsion injury. And what we had to do was graft them on some new eyelids. Because if you don't, big problems occur. Some examples. Give you a example of Bell's palsy. That's a paralyzed seventh nerve. And if they paralyze that nerve, they won't be able to close or blink their eyes properly. Besides finding out the reason, the underlying reason for their Bell's palsy, your main job as a healthcare provider is going to be to lubricate that eye. If you do not lubricate the eye, it will dry out like a potato chip. The surface epithelium will break down. We'll lose one of our barriers that we learned in immunity, and we can end up with a very serious eye infection. I'll give you an extreme example. In the ICU, you'll see lots of patients, and you'll notice that they appear to be staring just up at the ceiling. They may be in a comatose or semi-comatose state, and they can't close their eyes all the way. I got consulted to see those patients all the time, and we had to do something to prevent their eyes from drying out. Worst example I could possibly give you is this, and this didn't happen here. It happened somewhere else long, long time ago. I was consulted to see an AIDS patient in the ICU, and the order I wrote on the chart was to put in eye drops and artificial tear ointment every 1 hour around the clock to lubricate their eyes because they weren't closing their eyes properly because they were in a comatose state. So I came back for a follow-up visit, and I noticed that on the corneas, the front window to the eye here, there was an infection. The nurse decided that putting eye drops and eye ointment in wasn't that important. She had more important things to do, like, you know, pass the pills around and put in IVs and check EKGs. So she didn't lubricate the patient's eyes. And when I went in, there was a big white pus spot of an infection of the cornea of both eyes, which then penetrated the eye, went into the back of the eye, and ate the retinas off the eyeballs. Oh, yeah, by the way, it was methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. And the nurse thought my order was not important. She thought maybe the patient wasn't going to come out of a coma. And guess what happened? The patient woke up and was blind in both eyes. So that individual never practiced health care again. So, yes, our eyelids are important. Within the eyelids, there's a couple of structures I want you to know. This picture is a little bit hard from your text to look at. Here's a sagittal plane through the eyeball showing a, you know, cross section through the eyelids. Within each eyelid, shown here in green, is a thick fold of connective tissue. It's called the tarsal plate. It does give support to the eyelids. You may have known little Mikey in the third grade, always a little Mikey in the third grade. He kind of figured this system out. He was able to flip his eyelids. Right at this point here, we would fold his eyelids up and try to scare everybody and freak everybody out in the class. Some people, by the way, are born without good tarsal plates, or with age they start to degenerate, and their eyelids actually get very, very loose. So at night when they're sleeping, they sort of fold up and turn inside out by themselves, and during the nighttime, they scratch their eye. I saw those patients come in the morning with all scratched up eyeballs, and of course, had to treat them appropriately. And there was a name for that condition, and it really was, or really is, called floppy eyelid syndrome. So yes, these are important for support for our eyelids. Deep within them are some special oil glands that some genius called the tarsal glands. Yeah, the tarsal glands are in the tarsal plate. It ain't rocket science. These are special oil glands, and the oil is critical Maybe before today you didn't know your tear film had an oil layer. It's a very important layer. Yes, it lubricates the eyes, but it also slows tear film evaporation. It kind of goes like this. There's a layer of watery tears, right, plastered sort of on your cornea. Then on top of that is a film of oil. You know just by looking at salad dressing that oil and water don't mix. The oil floats on the water. Same thing on the top of your eyeball. There's an oil film, an oil slick on top of a watery tear film. And what the oil does is it prevents or reduces the evaporation rate of your watery tears. And you will absolutely see patients with problems with this. You can get problems with the tarsal glands, diseases like rosacea, where they don't make the right amount of oil, so their eyes dry out quickly, and they get recurrent infections. I saw it all the time, and you will too. Another example of how this is clinically relevant to the real world is some patients get blockages of the pores of these oil glands, and then the oil backs up into a big knot in the eyelid. You've seen people walk around with big old ugly red knots on their eyelids. In slang, they call them styes. Or a real term is called a chalazion if it's not infected. So I used to see those patients. They'd come in. A lot of times I'd look and find a piece of makeup like mascara plugging up the pore. And the way to treat it, and I know this is not a treatment course, so don't do what I say to do. Just, you know, we're just listening to this now for fun. We would try warm compresses to soften up the oil and help the oil come out the pore. And if that didn't work, we'd turn that lid kind of inside out, numb them up, slice that cyst open, so to speak, and out would come the cheese. So, yes, this is real life stuff. Some of you may have seen these pores, and I'm not telling you to do this, but if you were to go home and look in the mirror with a flashlight and look at, say, your right lower lid margin, you would see a series of a whole bunch of tiny dots, little pores, little openings, and some of them look like they have little tiny oily secretions on them. So what you're seeing are the pores of the oily tarsal glands. The next thing we'll look at is the thin mucous membrane that covers the whites of our eyeballs and also the inside surface of our eyelids. That thin mucous membrane that you could kind of see in the mirror is kind of shiny, has some little red blood vessels in it. That's called the conjunctiva. If people have an infection of that, they come in with a pink-looking eye, and the slang term is pink eye, but I bet you know the real term is conjunctivitis, which can be from a virus or bacteria or allergies. For our studying pleasure, however, the conjunctiva has been broken down into two. The bulbar conjunctiva is the mucous membrane that lines the front part of the sclera. So in other words, the conjunctiva on the front whites of our eyes, that's called the bulbar conjunctiva. Bulbar means ball, so that's the conjunctiva on the ball. Then we have the palpebral conjunctiva, and palpebral means eyelid, so you got it. That's what lines the inner surface of the eyelids. I'm not telling you to do this, but if you were to go home and pull the lower eyelid down, you would see a shiny, fleshy, pink membrane. That's the palpebral conjunctiva. This is a picture from your book, again, the sagittal plane through the eyeball. And what I'm trying to demonstrate here from this figure, which is kind of weak to tell you the truth, is my arrow tip, I'm first going to trace on the bulbar conjunctiva. That's the membrane on the whites of the eyes. Notice right here it makes a hairpin turn, a loop-de-loop, a pouch. Then it reflects and turns and covers the inside of this upper eyelid. So, my question to you, since you're advanced, is this. A patient comes in to see you and says, I lost my contact lens. It's behind my eye. can the contact lens really get behind your eye? I mean, way back here by the optic nerve. Well, for the purposes of our course, the answer is no, because it really gets stuck in this little folded over pouch that you now understand the anatomy of. So what I would do is sit them down, take a look. I would flip that upper lid inside out, and sure enough, the contact lens would almost always be up in there. There was one case I remember. It was an older woman, and of course, as we age, we lose manual dexterity, we lose sensation, and contact lens wearers in general, because of the process of adaptation, they lose sensitivity, they lose their pain sense. And I had a woman come in one time, says she lost her contact lens, and when I flipped her upper lid, I found 4 contact lenses in that little pouch. One more example I'll give you just for fun while you're maybe making notes or just enjoying the material is in the older days when we used more rigid contact lenses, there was a patient told me she lost her lens. And what happened was the contact lens actually eroded a hole through the conjunctiva, through that thin mucous membrane. It really did slip back here by the optic nerve, and we had to take her in the operating room under anesthesia and fish out a contact lens really from behind her eye. But if I ask you on the test, can a contact lens really get behind the eye? For all intents and purposes, you say no. Another accessory structure of the eye is shown here in the medial or inner corner of this right eye, a little sort of round mound, fleshy pink structure. It's called the lacrimal caruncle. It is a reddish piece of lumpy tissue in the inner corner of the eye. It has both sebaceous glands and sweat glands. And some people, if you look real close, there's even little hairs coming out of there. It really is, if you want to put off to the side here, it's a modified piece of skin. And that's why it has the things that you know skin has. It also produces from its glands some of that whitish material that often collects in the corner of the eye, especially in the morning. You wake up with the sleep in your eyes, a little mucus, or maybe a little crusties. And so now that you're advanced, if mama says, hey, you're big and bad, you're taking A&P, can you tell me why I got the sleep in the corner of my eye? You just say, yeah, it's because of that thing right there, the lacrimal caruncle. And you're at least partly right. I want to talk about that because I got a funny story on that too. When I was in college, I was standing in front of the mirror with a flashlight. Had no idea what I was doing there. No business standing there. But I looked in the corner of my eye and I saw that little lump of tissue. And I said to myself, oh my gosh, I got a tumor. And I went to the doctor. It was the same doctor. By now he's thinking something's wrong with me. I said, doctor, now I really think I really have a tumor. Look at this, these lumps in the inner corner of my eyes. He said, no. Those have always been there. Those are your lacrimal caruncles. You just never saw it before. Calm down. Finally, in this section, I want to finish with all the structures that produce and drain tears. That apparatus shown here mostly in green is called the lacrimal apparatus. Lacrimal, root word means tear, so it's our tear apparatus. I'm going to go through it using mostly the words, but there's 3 ways for you to learn it, depending on how your brain works. You could look at the diagram from your book where everything is nicely shown in green. You could look at the flow chart, or you could look at the words, whatever works best for you. So let's take a look at the lacrimal apparatus, all the structures that produce and drain tears. Starting with this, in the upper outer corner of the eye socket is the tear gland, which you will not call the tear gland. You will call it the lacrimal gland. That's what produces most of our tears. And let's stop right there. Remember, the big picture, half the battle in anatomy and physiology and healthcare is knowing where the parts are. Because you're not just taking this course for an A, you're taking it to help people. So someone now comes in to see you, maybe even a little kitty, with a big swollen red or painful lump, a new lump in the upper outer corner of their eye socket. Before you took the course, you might be thinking, well, I don't even know what's there. Now you know, it's a lacrimal gland, which can get infected and can even develop tumors. Even I've seen kids with malignant tumors, so you could save their life by detecting it and diagnosing it. Okay, from there the tears flow out through a series of tiny little ducts called excretory lacrimal ducts. They flow over the surface of the eye where they do their flushing and cleaning action. Next, they drain into two tiny openings. Each of those openings on the inner corners of our eyelid margins, they are called, the singular term is a lacrimal punctum. Your flowchart in your book left that out, so I corrected it with my red arrow. So penciled in, the tiny punctate openings are called the lacrimal punctum. The tears then flow into tiny little canals, conveniently called the superior and inferior lacrimal canals, which then flow into a sac-like structure called the lacrimal sac. I do want you to stop here for a second and make notes. Look where the lacrimal sac is. I don't care if it's on the test or not. You've got to know where it is, because it's in between the corner of your eyes and the bridge of your nose. And people will come see you, little kiddies or adults, with a swollen, red, tender knot there. And you'll say, well, what is that? Well, you got to know what's there. It's the lacrimal sac, which often gets infected in little kiddies. We'll talk more about that. From the lacrimal sac, which just means the tear sac, the tears then drain through this sort of tunnel or tubular-like structure called the nasolacrimal duct, which then empties into the nasal cavity. And I love that name, nasolacrimal duct, because it means nose tear duct. And did you ever notice this? When you cry, your nose kind of gets drippy and stuffy. Well, why? Because the tears drain through this pathway and eventually into your nose. Let's talk about the lacrimal punctum a little bit more, too. I'm not telling you to do this, but if you were to go home and get in the mirror with a flashlight and look on the inner corner of the eyelid, say maybe the right lower eyelid, you will notice a tiny little hole there. That's the opening. That's called the lacrimal punctum, and maybe you've already seen that. Then there was always little Mikey in the third grade who learned how to manipulate the system, right? He learned how to make things go backwards. And we, in the old days, we had these cartons of milk, like cardboard cartons of milk. And little Mikey, he'd get that, take a little gulp of that. First, he learned how to figure out how to get it in his nasal cavity. That's a whole special trick all in itself. But then once he got it there, he would get that milk to go backwards through the nasolacrimal duct, through the sac, out the canals, and then squirt milk out of his eyes through the lacrimal punctum. Anybody know little Mikey like that? Maybe it was just my third grade class. I don't know. Or maybe this. Maybe you saw someone, or maybe yourself. Maybe when you blew your nose one day, you saw a little mucus bubble come out that lacrimal punctum. That shows you the anatomy in reverse. Or maybe when you blew your nose, sometimes you feel that little air rush across your eye. That's air going backwards through the system. You should know this system forwards and backwards. Whether it's exam material or not, this is real life stuff, and I've showed you several things where you may see it. Little kitties will sometimes come see you with a red, glassy, gunky-looking eye, cake shut with pus. And there's lots of reasons for that, but a common one is something called dacryocystitis. You don't have to know what that disease is, but you need to know the anatomy of it. And the deal is this. Some little kitties are born with the nasolacrimal duct just not open well, and they get backup essentially. Since the tears can't flow all the way down, they get stuck in the lacrimal sac, and it's kind of like stagnant water in a pond. If you have stagnant water in a pond, what does it grow? It grows pond scum, you know, bacteria, organisms. Well, same thing in a kid with a blocked duct. The nasolacrimal sac will become infected, red, hot, swollen. I used to see him come in. Of course, we treat them with antibiotics initially. We cultured them to know what we were treating. And what we would do, I would press on that swollen sac, and oh yeah, it hurts. You're going to need help holding the kid down. Press on that press on that lacrimal sac, and then I'd be ready with my sterile Q-tip right out here because pus would come shooting out those lacrimal puncta where I could send it off for a culture and sensitivity examination. If antibiotics don't work and they keep getting recurrent ones, depending on lots of factors, sometimes we would then take them to surgery. And the surgery goes well by knowing the anatomy well. Under anesthesia, we would take a thin metal probe, kind of like a probe you use in lab, but a lot thinner. Put it through the lacrimal punctum, thread it through the lacrimal canal, get to the lacrimal sac. Then you have to angle your probe like 90 degrees, aim downwards through the nasal lacrimal duct, and just kind of ream it up and down like a roto-rooter. And that usually took care of them. Again, don't try that at home. Don't do anything I say, you know, as far as doing stuff. And by the way, it doesn't work on adults. It only works on kitties. So, yes, this is, once again, real life stuff, practical stuff that we need to know. We'll end this unit by looking at the last accessory structures of the eyes called the extraocular muscles. That just means the outside the eye muscles. Your book calls them extrinsic muscles, but nobody in the real world calls them that. So let's call them the right term, extraocular muscles. Off to your right are some figures, a lateral view and an anterior view. Basically, they are six strap-like, rubber band-like muscles that insert on the outside surface of the eye. Four of them I want you to know as rectus muscle. Your root word rectus means straight, and they go straight along the surface of the eye. And the four rectus muscles are the superior, the inferior, the lateral, and the medial. And they're located exactly where those directional terms tell you. And the function is easy. The superior rectus muscle on top of the eyeball, when it contracts, it pulls your eye up. The inferior rectus muscle on the bottom of the eyeball, it pulls the eye down. The lateral rectus muscle on the outside of the eyeball pulls the eye out. And the medial rectus muscle on the inside of the eye pulls the eye inwards. The last two muscles are called the oblique muscles. You remember from muscle anatomy that oblique means diagonal. So the two oblique muscles are the superior and inferior oblique muscles. They're hard to see, but the superior is on the top and it runs diagonally across the top of the ball. The inferior oblique muscle runs inferiorly and diagonally along the bottom of the eyeball. And these muscles kind of help to roll your eyes, so to speak, but I don't want you to know any more detail than that. I want to end this unit by giving you a practical application of knowing this material. You may have seen little kitties with an eye turned in towards the nose. Let's say in this top figure, this is a right eyeball, and we're going to turn it in, cross it in towards the nose. How do they fix that? Well, what they do under anesthesia, of course, is they cut under the conjunctiva. They find the lateral rectus muscle. They disinsert it from the eyeball. In other words, they cut it loose from the eyeball. Now, you can't let it go. If you let it go, it's going to snap back in the socket like a rubber band, and that's considered poor form. There's a name for that, by the way. It's called a lost muscle. But anyway, don't let it go. And then what they do, once they have this muscle isolated, is they'll cut off a piece of it. And there's specific measurements that they use. But let's say, for example, you have this muscle and take off a quarter inch of it. And then you reconnect it, suture it back down to the eyeball. By shortening this muscle and tacking it back down, can't you picture how that would pull that right eyeball back out and straighten it up? And that's how it works, essentially. So that's a good way, I think, to end this unit. I want to end this unit by giving you a practical application of knowing this material. You may have seen little kitties with an eye turned in towards the nose. Let's say in this top figure, this is a right eyeball, and we're going to turn it in, cross it in towards the nose. How do they fix that? Well, what they do, under anesthesia, of course, is they cut under the conjunctiva, they find the lateral rectus muscle. They disinsert it from the eyeball. In other words, they cut it loose from the eyeball. Now, you can't let it go. If you let it go, it's going to snap back in the socket like a rubber band, and that's considered poor form. There's a name for that, by the way. It's called a lost muscle. But anyway, don't let it go. And then what they do, once they have this muscle isolated, is they'll cut off a piece of it. And there's specific measurements that they use. But let's say, for example, you have this muscle and take off a quarter inch of it. And then you reconnect it, suture it back down to the eyeball. By shortening this muscle and tacking it back down, can't you picture how that would pull that right eyeball back out and straighten it up? And that's how it works, essentially. So that's a good way, I think, to end this unit.